My name is Michael Eskebum, and I'd like to welcome everybody to another episode of Spotlight. Today, as our guest, we have Doug Lee. The interviewer will be Steve Shepherd. Our two recorders are Dennis and Becky. I'd also like to wish Steve Pallett, on behalf of the Spotlight Committee, a very fast and speedy recovery from his back ailments. All right, Steve, it's all yours.
Well, thanks, Michael, and hello, everyone, and welcome to Spotlight. I was asked to interview one Doug Lee, who, in addition to being a good friend of mine, is one of the best scripters around, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about that, too. Hi, Doug. How you doing?
Doing all right, and hello, everybody. I consider it doubly appropriate that Steve ends up doing this interview because Steve is actually the person that got me onto For the People. We'll probably get to that in a little bit as well.
Okay, well, let's get started, Doug. I've known you for some time, and I know a little bit about you, and then let's let everyone else know some about you, too. You're a very interesting guy. So how did it all start, Mr. Lee? Where were you born? Tell us a little bit about your family, whatever you want to say.
Well, my short answer to that when somebody says where I was from is I say I was born in Nebraska, raised in Illinois, and moved to Virginia from Minnesota. But for a little more detail than that, I was born in Lincoln, Nebraska. I only lived there for about 18 months. Moved to Illinois, I believe it was because my dad transferred for his job, but I'm not quite sure the details of that. That's kind of before my memory. Spent most of my life in Illinois, and then moved to Minnesota in for about 9 months in 91, but I moved there in 1997 and lived there for about 2.5 years, and I moved to Virginia after that. But all the time between about 1969 and 1997, I lived in Springfield, Illinois, and from 1981 to 1997, I lived in one house, which seems kind of rare these days. I lived with my mom. My family divorced, or my parents divorced in 1980, and my dad now lives in Kansas. So I start naming off all these states and cities, and it's like it makes it sound like I've been everywhere, but that's basically that. I will say now that I could, before I moved to Illinois, I could see, but I don't remember vision. I'm probably a little bit heavy on that one, but I could see for 18 months. I don't remember anything of it now.
Okay, interesting. You could see, and you said you were 18 months when you moved. What happened to your vision, Doug? I mean, you were born fully sighted, and then what happened?
Well, as best I know the story from what my parents told me, I was, yes, fully sighted, doing what kids normally do, playing with the toys and stuff, using my vision, and I had this set of rings that you stack on a tapered pole. There's probably a name for this, but I remember it actually from feeling it, not from seeing it. It was a kind of a tapered wooden or plastic post, and there were these rings that went around it that were different sizes, and there were different colors. Of course, I didn't remember that later. And apparently what happened in Nebraska was I started using my hands, not my eyes, to do it, and my parents got worried about that. And they asked me, they took me to an eye doctor. And the eye doctor took a look at me and said, he's fine. And, that happened a couple of times. He didn't use any instruments, I'm told. He just sort of looked with his naked eye. And then we moved to Illinois. And we went to a doctor there. And the doctor took one look at me and said that there was a problem. And he sent me straight to Chicago Children's Hospital. Now, considering I was in Springfield, Illinois, which is about 4 or 4.5 hour drive from Chicago, that was a pretty serious statement. So they took me to Chicago Children's Hospital, and there they found out that I had a rare condition called retinoblastoma, which is a cancer of the eyes. And they tried all kinds of, whatever they had at the time, but basically, they had chemotherapy, they had radiation treatments, I actually have a small, I call it a tattoo, but I have a little tiny ink mark in the middle of my forehead, but you can't see it unless you really, really know it's there, that they use to aim radiation with. They tried to save one of my eyes. They tried to do one and leave the other one, but I ended up having at least two surgeries because that didn't work. And for some reason, right in the middle of all this radiation and chemotherapy, there was a little tiny mix-up in the hospital, and a nurse walks in and gives me a measles vaccine. If anybody knows about chemotherapy, it's not a good idea to give somebody a live vaccine because you don't have any immune system. So I had one heck of a case of the measles, they tell me. This caused some confusion as to whether I'm allergic to penicillin or not, because they didn't know if it was from penicillin or from the measles vaccine that I'd reacted to something. But during that process of trying to get rid of the cancer, they tried to obviously contain it, but the radiation liquefied the tumor. And the liquid got into my blood. And the doctor, on realizing that, basically said that there was nothing they could do about that and that I wasn't going to make it, and he sent me home. This is after my, what they call enucleations, you know, where they took my eyes. And so they had given up. Well, my mom is a Christian. I'm a Christian. And my mom had been praying rather furiously during all this process, you know, Lord, please save my son. And she came to a day when she decided to pray a little differently. She said, Father, if you can't save, or if you don't want to save my son, please at least give me the strength to deal with that. According to what she tells me, I don't know if it was the next day, but it was very shortly thereafter, I got a test, and they said that my white blood cell count was going down. They didn't know why. And that generally means the cancer's going away or going into remission or something. And that continued. They kept giving me tests, and it was going down, going down, going down. Finally, it was back to normal. And they're like, there's no trace anymore. We don't understand what happened. He's fine. We want him to come back periodically for more tests because we don't understand how this is possible. So my mom and I tend to believe that prayer has a lot of power. So I guess that's the full length version of what happened, but also a bit about why it means something to me. I believe it is some of where my faith comes from, but it's also, you know, blindness sometimes is considered by people to be very scary and very, you know, some people are afraid of blindness more than death. And my comment is, well, it seems to me there was a choice in my life somewhere, and I'm glad I'm still here.
Wow, that's quite a story of your blindness, and sometimes I don't like to spend a lot of time on people's blindness, but I'm glad you told us the long version because it incorporated so much. I mean, that's quite a case of the measles you got there, and thanks for bringing in the part that faith plays in your life, and we'll probably talk more about that later because I know that that's a big part of your life, and so I'm glad to know some of that background. Now, I wanted to ask you, I've known a lot of people who are blind as toddlers around the age that you are. Do you remember vision at all? Do you remember colors? Do you think that having sight in your early life gave you any head start or advantage in, say, spatial orientation? I know you're a good traveler, for example. Do you think, have you ever thought about whether it's made a big difference in your life that you did have vision, even though it was before your memory?
Well, first of all, I don't remember vision at all. I used to try as a kid. I used to have what they call lucid dreams, dreams that you can control and you know are dreams. And I would deliberately decide, okay, I'm standing on a sidewalk and there's a store down the street, I'm going to see it. And I would stand there and concentrate and try to remember how to see it. And it never worked. All I could get my eyes to do is kind of like burn a little bit or something tactile. I have absolutely no conscious memory of vision. Whether it helped my spatial perception consciously, no. Otherwise, I'm not sure, but I really doubt it. I think, for all intents and purposes, I am like being blind from birth. I've always figured it's harder to lose it if you remember it than to not have had it in the first place. I kind of feel like I grew up this way and this is all I've known. But it does strike me as a curious question because, as I said before, my parents saw me doing things with my vision when I was a child, you know, making the rings go in the right order and following things. A very quick story that I forgot to mention, according to my mom, the day that I learned to walk was in the hospital, and it was vision related. I had been losing vision enough that I couldn't see a lot of things, but she was going to take my picture, and I was in a hallway in the hospital. And this is, of course, back in, you know, when you had the cameras with the flash, and she flashed the camera, and I saw the flash, let go of what I was hanging on to and walk right over to it. That's what she tells me. But I have no memory of this and no memory of vision whatsoever.
Okay. So tell me more about your family, your brothers and sisters or whatever that your family makeup.
Well, I seem to have a fast answer for everything and then a full-length one. My fast one is I have 1.5 brothers and a half-sister, and one of my brothers is 2.5 months younger than me. To unravel all that, I have an adopted brother who is also blind. He was adopted when we were both 4, and he is 2.5 months younger than me. I have had no other siblings for most of my life. But as I said, in 1980, my family split, and my dad remarried roughly 4 or 5 years later and had a son and a daughter who are now 19, 20 or so. And I haven't talked to them as often, but for the most part, I lived with my mom and my brother most of my life up until 1997 when I moved out of Illinois. My mom is fairly good with computers. As far as what she does, she works for the Environmental Protection Agency. EPA is easier to say. My dad has done a number of things. He's actually been a licensed clinical social worker. He does that kind of thing. He's also helped run a nursing home system. He does carpentry for a hobby, and he taught me a number of interesting things with that. I believe I got my exploratory nature from my dad and my feelings from my mom. My mom is a very emotionally founded person, and my dad is much more logical based and curious about the world, which I also like quite a bit.
You come by your technical ability, honestly, I guess, from your mother, and your high intelligence from your educated parents. How about your education, Doug? I mean, tell us how that proceeded.
Well, actually, I didn't really get my technical foundation from my mom. I probably got my curiosity about things, first mechanical and then electronic and whatnot, from my dad. My introduction into computers was pretty much from a surprise source. I had a friend named Bob. My brother's name is Bob. This is another Bob. In Illinois, who I got in contact with through another friend who was trying to ask me something. I don't remember exactly why we came into contact, but in my first or second year of high school, actually I think it was my second year of high school, Bob and I started talking, and he was working, I don't remember if he was working in a computer job at the time, but he had a fascination with computers, and he had an old K-Pro at the time, or at least soon thereafter. We started talking about it, and he decided that even though he knew I was interested in electronics, he thought I should get into computers. And at that time, I was trying to do things like figure out how to get my dad to build a speaker cabinet and try to get money to buy a stereo, which in high school was quite a feat when I wasn't working. But Bob talked me into taking a computer class. And in my junior year of high school, I took one, and I always joke with people if they've never been the same since. It was a class in BASIC, I learned it on Apples with the old Echo 2 synthesizer. And I basically went from there. I took to it so much. Not only was I writing all the programs the teacher asked me to, I was writing all the extra credits, I was learning assembly language, machine code, and stuff like that while I was taking BASIC. The teacher of the class actually came up to me one day and said, "Doug, you don't have to do all the extra credit assignments, you know." I said, "I know that," but I still wanted to. I was just absorbing this stuff like a sponge. I was getting this poor Bob that I mentioned to read me. I got manuals on the Apple computers from the school office, and I sent them to him and had him reading stuff to me out of the manuals over the phone for hours and hours. So I think I was kind of lucky, because by the time I got anywhere near college, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I went to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and I got a computer science degree, which took a little longer than expected because I took some time off in the middle to go to Minnesota for training, which we might get to as well. But I did that and have just basically stuck with it. I think it's probably unusual. I don't know if this is true, but I think it might be unusual that I was that focused. I even met a senior one time in college that didn't know what his major was. I was like, boy, am I glad I knew this ahead of time.
Boy, I can believe that you soaked it up like a sponge, knowing you and, you know, how good a scripter you are. And I really envy your focus and knowing what you wanted to do. Well, how about high school and elementary school? Were you mainstream? Did you go to a public school, or how did that all go?
Yep, I went to a public school. I guess you'd say I was mainstream, but I'm not sure if they do it the same way now as they did then. I had regular classes. I was in classes with regular, you know, sighted students. But we also had what we call the resource room, where we had our supplies, our braille paper, braille writers, tape recorders, abacus, whatever, eventually talking calculator. And we had people there that would translate everything between braille and print. So when the class received a ditto to do, we received a braille copy of the ditto. When the class took a test, we had a braille copy, and we used braille writers to take the test, and we did it in the class, usually. So it was mainstream, but with a translation system in place to where we kind of got everything as much as possible at the same time as everybody else. That is the way it worked all the way through high school. Of course, it doesn't work that way in college, but that's a different story. I basically had that kind of translation system in place all the way through the end of high school. There is one small stint I did in a residential school for the blind. It was a summer program, and it was for 4 weeks. And actually, I've met some people for the people here that were there when I was. And I said it was interesting, it was fun, I immediately fit in, but I was kind of glad that I was mainstream, because I wanted to keep kind of track of how things work for everybody else and know that I could deal with that. And I believe that's a very important thing to be able to do, because when you go out to college, you kind of need to be able to do that, because you're not going to have a specialized environment that gives you everything translated ahead of time. You end up having to work it out.
You know, I was kicked out of the room there. I'm glad that I got back in so quickly, but I missed part of the last part of the answer. But I know you were mainstreamed, and you had a small stint in summer. Now, had you known blind people before that? Did you even know there were a lot of blind people around, or how was that?
I had some classmates in the resource room that I basically knew all of my educational life, because every blind student in the city of Springfield was sent through the same school. Basically, so we had roughly 5 or 6 of us at any given time that were going through one school, and our resource room was a common room, so we would all meet and we all got to know each other extremely well. Other than that, though, I didn't know of any larger group of blind people until about 1983 or 4. and I bumped into the National Federation of the Blind at that point and discovered a whole lot of blind people. But until then, that's pretty much all I knew. When I went to Jacksonville is when I met a bunch of other blind people. A little earlier than that, maybe 82 or so, but I don't remember any other... Oh, I guess I did a little bit play goalball and beaver ball and meet a few blind people, but no, I didn't have any real touch with the number of blind people in the U.S. or anything like that until later.
I see. You fit right in at the summer program because, of course, you were with a bunch of people who were experiencing the same type of lifestyle that you were. I suppose the reason that's interesting to me is because I had a similar experience, so that's why I wanted to ask you more about that. You chose University of Illinois. Why? Because they had a computer science program, or because it was close to your house, or what?
Well, actually, I don't remember for sure, but I bet you there were two reasons. One, it was well recognized for its computer education ability. It was well renowned for computer science curriculum. But also, Chip, one of my friends from before that I mentioned without saying names, Chip Johnson, who now works in Colorado, went through school with me, and he decided to go there as a Spanish major. And so he could basically tell me, you know, he had checked out a few different colleges, and his comments about how the university worked, which I don't remember in detail right now, but I remember thinking, well, man, this sounds like kind of a cool place, and I decided it'd be kind of fun to be there. Again, I think I was lucky, because you don't usually want to choose your college based on where your friends went, but in this case it worked out real well, because it was a good college for me to go to for my degree. I did have a couple of issues with the rehab system there, but that's probably universal. But yeah, it probably ended up being more the academic thing, but I do remember thinking that having Chip to go there a year ahead of me and comment on how things work was very helpful.
Okay. Now, did you do a lot of higher math as a computer science major? A lot of people ask, well, you have to be good in math, right, to do computer programming. Comment on that.
Well, the short answer is yes. I had to do 3 semesters of calculus, 3 semesters of physics, and I had to do 2 semesters of chemistry, but I actually did 3 because I was afraid of chemistry, and I took a kind of a pre-chemistry course because a lot of my high school chums had been taking pre-chem in high school, and I hadn't done that or physics or calculus or anything. So I felt like I was coming at it kind of dry. But that's an interesting one, because in doing that, I discovered a number of problems. Readers don't always know how to read some of this stuff. You know, I'd get a reader that didn't know any Greek symbols, and I'd be taking a physics exam, and I'd say 2 times theta, and they'd have to go into a book and look up theta, and I'm like, I don't want you to time my exam while this guy is flipping through a book trying to find out how to write the symbol I just dictated. There was also the fact that people didn't know how to braille it. Readers reading books on the tape would run into trouble. There's one reader that I discovered who tried to read physics equations without reading the Greek symbols at all, so he just jumped right over them. And, of course, that sort of messes up an equation slightly. But one of the things that I ended up having to do, there's 2 things I had to do on my own to adapt some of this. One of them was that in one of the classes I took, and I actually had to take a computer architecture class and a circuit design class, which has the similarity of involving a lot of symbols and diagrams and equations and things. And I kind of devised a way of brailing circuit diagrams that doesn't involve nearly as much trouble as, say, doing it with a tracing wheel. I had to look at several different books. There was a Braille library of sorts in the rehab center at the U of I and I saw a couple of different Braille codes. For anybody that knows a lot of Braille, there's the Nemeth Braille code, which is a commonly accepted one for doing math and scientific things of that sort. And then there is another one whose name I don't remember, but I remember being very confused because the numbers were in the upper part of the cell and the positive negative signs were, a negative sign was like a .26, which is, looks like the letter EN or the number 5. And it was very hard to read that. It was something of a process of improvision to figure out how to do some of this. And I had to do a little, I had actually come up with a way of doing circuit diagrams later because I took a computer music class, and I came up with a way of drawing, which I could go into if we have time and interest. But as far as whether you need math to do computers, I always tell people you need the logic. You absolutely need the logic that you get from doing math, from algebra. You even need some algebra because just about any program is going to have some elements of algebra in it. You don't, strictly speaking, need all the higher level math itself. I don't usually have to take derivatives and all that stuff that you did in calculus to write programs, but the logical foundation you get from doing the math, yes, you absolutely do need that.
Okay, so you do need a logical mind, but plenty of programmers are programmers who did not take math. In other words, you need the mind, but you don't really need the math, right?
Yeah, you know how they have what we call story problems in math? What you need, absolutely, is the same ability that you use to break a story problem into something you can solve. Programs are major-sized story problems sometimes. You know, you have something you need to do, you have to break it down into small pieces and figure out how to fit them together. Programming, I guess, I think of as largely a job of that plus translating into a very specific, strict language. My favorite story of how programming was explained to a person was, I think it was my mom's class, one of the classes she was in as a kid. Her teacher said, I want you to, he wrote like 10 commands on the board, 10 words or phrases. He says, using only the things on the board, I want you all to write down a sequence of steps that would cause me to smoke a cigarette. And so people write things like pick up match, pick up cigarette, light match, put cigarette to mouth, inhale. And what he would do is he would follow these instructions as religiously as a computer, and if they missed something, so would he. So the set of instructions I just gave, pick up match, pick up cigarette, light match, put cigarette to mouth, inhale. Well, at this point you have a match burning in one hand and you have a very burning cigarette in your mouth and in the other hand, and you're breathing through it, and the class is giggling profusely and learning why it is that you need a logical mind in order not to miss the step of lighting the cigarette.
Oh, that's funny, that's funny. Just as I was lighting a cigarette here. Yeah, you gotta get every little step in programming. I'm sort of a programmer wannabe, and let me let you know, folks, I've learned a lot from Doug Lee in JAWS programming anyway. So, okay, well, let's move on to your professional life a little bit, Doug, and your personal life as much as we have time for and your desire to share. So you got a degree in computer science, and I'm sure you did quite well, so then what happened? Were you a programmer? Were you a teacher? Or just what happened?
Well, I'm going to start right before college. Right before college, I got a summer job in Illinois, which was a little ambitious. I don't remember how this came to pass, but I was asked to write a book inventory system for the Springfield Depository of Materials for the Blind and Disabled. I don't remember its exact name. It was something roughly equivalent to that. And I was like, I don't know. I mean, I know BASIC. I know Pascal, because I took a Pascal class in my senior year of high school. And I could write this in BASIC, but I didn't know what a book inventory system was supposed to do. So I realized right off I needed to interview the lady that ran the place, but she was very busy. So for a while I was writing code that I figured I would need before I figured out what the program was supposed to do. That job didn't quite pan out to anything other than a lot of experience. In other words, I wrote a lot of code, but nothing came of it. They didn't use it because I didn't really know how to do what they wanted. But that was my first sort of professional experience. My next one was a big surprise to me. I was called at the University of Illinois to work at AT&T Bell Laboratories in Naperville, Illinois, for the summer of 1986. And that was because the literal case of a friend of a friend. Somebody at AT&T said they were looking for a blind programmer. They called a person at the rehab agency in Naperville. That person called a friend of his in Illinois who happened to be a good friend of mine, and she called me. So I ended up working for 10 weeks in 86 and 10 weeks in 87 as a programmer. Actually, in 86, in 87 they called me a summer student, which I thought made sense. And in 86, to my amusement, they called me a casual employee. I never did know quite what that was supposed to mean. But I worked for 10 weeks each year. In 1990, I had a short-term consulting job installing speech software for a person working at a chemical dependency center. And then I was contracted by that company to train her how to use it. But my first, what I consider full-time professional position was in 1992, right after I got out of college. The same Bob that I mentioned that got me into computers in the first place, at that time was working for a company called Metrovision, and he talked his boss into hiring me as a programmer, and I ended up being the programmer on staff, because they were trying to write programs, but they both knew they weren't really programmers, and I was, so they hired me to do it. It was a small company. The name caused some confusion, because when we went to a demo for, I wrote software for schools and school systems, mostly, and also membership organizations and stuff like that, for record keeping, database applications mostly. But, you know, we go to this meeting for school board people and whatnot, and people that might be interested in software for schools, and they see this sign that says Metrovision, and they see this guy standing there with a cane demonstrating. They come and say, so you sell adaptive technology, yes? I was like, well, no. Yeah, I'm blind. Yeah, my computer talks to me. But I'm actually here selling a program to run the school cafeteria, which is the biggest program I wrote there. We called it Cafeteria Billing and Accounting, or CBA. And it was in charge of keeping track of balances for students and whatnot, and also keeping the photos and making photo IDs of students. Never thought I'd be one to have to write a program to manage pictures, but that's one of the things I had to do there. And from then I went to, from there I worked there for 5 years, and then I went to teach in Minnesota for 2.5 years at a training center, which I had also been to as a student in 1991, called Blind Inc., Blindness Learning in New Dimensions. It's blind is an acronym there. And decided that I would really prefer to be a programmer rather than a teacher. So I came back to the field of programming more or less by going to Virginia, which is where I am now, and becoming a JavaScripter. And that's what I do now.
Okay. Well, you skimmed over your teaching experience, Doug. I've known you to be a programmer, but also you're very willing to take the time to explain things to people. And you're a very good teacher. So that experience, I think, stood you in good stead, at least to me. Tell us a little bit more about your teaching experience.
Well, I had kind of a history, for some reason, of jumping into jobs and then getting ready for them, and that was no exception. When I started programming, I didn't know the language, the network, or half the people I was working with. When I went to teach, I was hired by Joyce Scanlon, who then was the director of Blind Ink, and she was very well acquainted with me because I'd been a student there for 9 months, and she knew that I didn't really use JAWS, but she also knew I was a quick study, and she hired me, and I had never actually run, as far as I remember, well, I guess I'd run one version of JAWS for Windows, but I'm not even sure about that. I may not have even seen JAWS for Windows by the day I got there. She had the students go on a field trip the very first day, Monday, that I came there. It was October of 1997. So that I would have one day in the lab to kind of get my feet on the ground, and then Tuesday I was teaching. Well, I was accustomed to doing things in a very different way. I didn't use Windows for mail. In those days, we just had a program called Internet Mail, I believe. And I didn't do it that way. So I had a lot of things I didn't really know when I started teaching. And I had to spend a lot of time learning what I was teaching ahead of time. And I remember one day I was downstairs in the basement of Blind Ink making dinner, making spaghetti, and listening to a JAWS training tape while I was making spaghetti. And I then started eating, and I was still listening to the JAWS training tape, and I realized about three-quarters of the way through my meal, where's the sauce? You know, I'm seeing the spaghetti on my plate, and there's no sauce. And I honestly, to this day, I don't know if I ever made it and forgot to eat it, or if I never made it, or if I made it and forgot to eat it, or what happened. And I decided I was like too busy. You know, if I'm studying so much that I can't even remember what I'm eating. But it was like that for a while. I very much prefer to teach stuff I know extremely well and use every day. I believe if I am very skilled at something, very good at it, and very accustomed to doing it, and sometimes if I'm just learning it and have a lot of interest in it, I can be good at teaching, I can be very patient, but I really prefer to work with computers only because I am actually an introvert. A lot of people say they wouldn't know that, but I am. And it was hard for me to teach for 8 hours a day. That's really what happened to me. It was hard for me to do that the whole day. But I'm sure it did help me. It, in fact, caused me to get my current job because the people that hired me thought I would be a teacher when they hired me. They didn't know I was going to be a scripter, and I kept telling them, I'd prefer to script, and they said, well, we'll see. And we all saw.
Boy, I didn't know they hired you thinking you'd be a teacher. Interesting. Okay, well, how about this job that you're doing now and the job that you got after your teaching? Tell us a little bit about who you're working for, if you want to, and what you do, and how you learn scripting.
Well, the company is called Bartimaeus Group. We haven't taught JAWS to say that right. JAWS says Bartimaeus Group, or if you use the deck talk, I think it says Bartimaeus for Bartimaeus. But I basically met the one of the owners of Bartimaeus Group at a job fair at the NFB convention in 2000. Yeah, 2000. And I was looking for them, and they were looking for me at the same time because they had apparently overheard me talking to somebody else, and I had gone through a list of people at the fair, and I had picked them out as one of the people I wanted to go talk to. They really had to talk me into coming out here, though, because I did not want to leave Minnesota. I really did not want to leave Minnesota. I didn't want to move. They about had to pull me out of there by the ears. But they did, because I guess they wanted me to... They figured from what they saw and from me talking to them that I was a good fit. I am very happy that they succeeded in making me do it because there's a lot of elements of this job that are cool. I love programming, and obviously scripting is a form of programming. I like to visit different places, and the job I have now basically sends me to various companies and government agencies that need scripting done to make computers accessible to blind people, either to fulfill what they call Section 508 of the Rehab Act, or to make a particular person's job more effectively workable. So I end up going different places. Done a fair amount of work in Georgia. Been to Alabama. I'm going to Texas pretty soon. I'm going to Tennessee in about 2 days. It's very nice to visit different places. It's also a small company, and I guess I like small companies a lot because you can know the people, and it's not a big corporate structure that you have to deal with if you have an issue. I prefer a place where you can be friends with the people you work with. You obviously have to draw lines between them occasionally. You know, my manager and I are friends, but when he says do it, he's saying as a manager, not a friend, and you know, you got to deal with that. But I really do like that kind of environment, and I have it.
Very good. Very good. I know that you enjoy the job. Let me just say here in the middle of the interview that we're doing Spotlight, and Doug Lee is being interviewed, and I'm Steve Shepard, for anyone who doesn't know. So, Doug, how did you learn scripting? I mean, you weren't a scripter before you got that job, were you?
Nope. Once again, I had never used or written, or not used, I've used JavaScript. So I'd never written and barely looked at a JavaScript before I came out here. As a matter of fact, when I was in Minnesota and Bartimaeus was trying to yank me out into Virginia, I was busily studying to try to take a position at a local internet service provider as a tech support person. And just for grins, sometime later I submitted my resume to him and nothing came of it whatsoever, so I suspect that it was just as well I got yanked out of Minnesota and brought to Virginia. I do tend to be a system administrator as part of the jobs I've had. I didn't mention that. It just sort of happened in all three of them. As far as how I learned scripting, I basically started through the manual that came with the scripting, came with JAWS, wrote some of the exercises, read some of the code that they had. But that's really not a complete picture, because by that time I had already learned a bunch of programming languages, and once you've learned a bunch of programming languages, learning a new one is basically like, you know, you look at it like, okay, so what is the syntax in this one? What commands do you have? What can you do? What can you not do? You don't have to worry about figuring out the logic of programming itself. And so what I would say to people that are interested in scripting, if you already know programming, obviously you're going to do probably about what I did, but it's very different the way I did it than what you would probably do if you didn't know programming. The manual started out nicely enough, but it got complicated real fast, and I don't think that is the current manual. I don't know how much has changed since then. But specifically to learning scripting, I basically did it by that. The one other thing, though, that taught me scripting was what I call an immersion experience. I had only been working for Bartimaeus for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and they said, well, we need you to go to Florida to script an application out there. I'm like, ooh, whoa, I'm still learning how to write this, but okay, whatever I can do. And they said, and we need you to make it work with a Braille display. And I'm like, oh, no, I haven't looked at that at all. I don't know how you run a Braille display from JAWS. So once again, I have to learn while I'm in the middle of it experience. I'm out in Florida figuring out how to run a Braille display. So I learned a lot of scripting by fire, as it were, you know, being out there and while there are people looking over my shoulder figuring out how I was doing it.
Wow, that's amazing. I have done very little with Braille scripting, and the little I've done has chased me right away from Braille scripting. So, huh? That's amazing that you did it on the job. I want to ask you a question later, before the end, about what is scripting, Doug, but I don't want to get off on a tangent there yet. You're an excellent programmer. You've told us about your background. There's also a lot of other aspects to your life. You're, in addition to being just a terrifically nice guy, you're also somewhat of a poet and have the, you know, soul of an artist. So how is it that a computer programmer, geek type person is very rounded as far as liberal arts and producing beauty? I mean, tell us about your art and your poetry.
A lot of the poetry, I didn't like writing poetry in school. I had to write poetry for class once, and I thought it was a chore. I don't quite know why this worked the way it did, but I had a friend in college that one day said to me, if you believed in reincarnation, what would you be next time around? And I didn't know how to answer her. But she was a very interesting and inspiring friend, and somehow or other it came to be that instead of writing her a straight answer, I wrote her a poem. And that caused her to want me to do more of it. And I wrote a fairly large number of poems between 1989 and 1991 or two. I've written a few since then, not nearly as many. Tried composing songs. I never really completed that because I don't know music and it's hard to keep track of it without having some way of recording it. I did mess with recording music from a keyboard and using tapes, tape copying and echoes and stuff with a tape deck to make multi-layer recordings where I could actually play three parts at a time. As to how that fits into programming to me is exactly a blend of art and science, and I am definitely some of both. I chose as my other nickname on For the People, Carpenter of Logic, which confuses a number of people, but there's two reasons for that. I guess one of them is that I, being a Christian, like to imitate a fairly well-known carpenter, if I can, but the other one is that programming is the building of a structure out of building blocks, out of pieces, but it is simultaneously the art of creating something that has not been made before, which is also, you know, true of carpentry. You build a house, it's going to contain some of your ideas, some of your creativity. And I guess I view programming that way, and I like both parts of it very much.
Okay. Good answer. I think that programming is a very creative experience, and creation is kind of a soul experience, really, just like an architect, just like even a carpenter, like you were saying. The geeks of the world are creative. It is an art. Good answer. Thank you. Doug, you are also involved in NFB, I know, National Federation for the Blind. Maybe you could expand a little bit on that.
Well, I joined in about 84. I'll try to summarize this because it covers a lot of ground, but I basically initially thought it was extremely, well, the common word is militant, but at that time I didn't know the word, so I probably thought of it as crazy, because when I joined, they were fighting over exit row seating and such in airplanes. But I did hear a lot of philosophy I liked, about being independent, about being able to do things more than unable to do things, about trying things, which I have more fear than it would appear I do. There's a lot of things I am afraid of trying, and I don't want to be. So someone who encourages me in some way to be more fearless is probably going to be a person I appreciate. But I really have to admit, when I first started, I think the biggest draw to it was the absolute euphoric freedom of being able to do something like wander out of a totally unfamiliar hotel with a pack of 10 people, go find the Kingfish restaurant in Louisville, Kentucky, with no idea where it was, and not be afraid of getting lost. It's an unparalleled sense of freedom. It feels boundless, like you can do anything. Because there's so many blind people, you're not going to get stopped on the street and bothered by sighted people. We took over. I mean, it basically felt like we had our own world going there. And that's what I felt in my first introduction to the organization. The NFB has also done a number of things for me, and this is what I'm going to have to gloss over for lack of time. The Illinois Department of Rehabilitation Services, otherwise known as DOORS, decided that they wanted to take a scholarship away from me once, and the scholarship was given to me on the basis of merit. As a matter of fact, it was an NFB scholarship, and the NFB helped me fight a legal battle to keep them from doing it that eventually resulted in a national law that forbids them to do it on a national scale. The other one was I was in 1992 living on the fifth floor of a dorm, and the resident director walked in one day and said he needed me to move to the first floor because they were afraid that I wouldn't be able to get out of the building in case of a fire. And I'm thinking, I actually think I said this, I said, I don't think you've seen me go down the stairs. My problem isn't going too slow, my problem is going too fast. So the NFB kind of helped me prevent that from happening. The rehab system on campus actually told me, had they known I was coming, they wouldn't have allowed me to move in onto the fifth floor, which, you know, this is kind of one of the things I was alluding to earlier when I said I had a few issues with the rehab system. I don't believe that's the right way to try to encourage a blind person who's going to college for the purpose of becoming independent. If you're going to be an independent person, you need to be able to deal with stairs and stuff without having people being afraid of it. So I guess I've been going to conventions regularly since then. I'm probably a quieter member than a lot of people. I'm not real proactive. I don't tend to go to legislative events, go to, you know, Congress and write senators and all that. But I do believe in the philosophy, and I try to explain it to people. And when I teach people, I try to give them that, you know, ability to think of themselves as capable people and not handicapped people in the sense of being unable to do something. I really, really strongly want people to feel self-sufficient, because it's a very, very beautiful feeling, and I would wish it for everyone that can manage it. And so that's a lot of why I stay there.
And so here's a guy who can go to Florida 2 or 3 weeks after getting a new job by himself and get around by himself and be proud of it, and then the same paragraph say that he has got a lot of fears and things that he doesn't do out of fear. Well, seems to me you're a person that faces your fears and conquers them as best you can. So that's interesting that NFB has been a part of your life and you've really benefited from that association. So congratulations. Doug, you're also a person of faith. You have quite a Christian faith, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about how that plays in your life.
Well, I've been to a number of different kinds of churches. Off the top of my head, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Baptist, Methodist, one that didn't name itself anything but Lakeside Christian. I believe first that I believe in God. I believe in obviously the Christian faith, the tenets of Christian faith, and Jesus and what he did, stood for, what he did. I also believe, though, that in the way things are in the world now, you can't easily express that in the way that I see it often expressed without simply turning people away. There's a sort of defense mechanism that goes into effect. I've never become an evangelist, so to speak, because I've seen some of that even inside my family. And I would prefer to have people see me. You know, one of the poems that I wrote says, "Though I'm hurt when you don't understand, it is not my way to force you to see." I prefer to live that way. I don't want to ram something down somebody's throat, but I want them to see it and then do with it what they think they can or what they want to. You know, that's a little unusual for Christianity in a way, because Christians are told to go out and tell the world, and well, I hope I am in a certain way, but I've never been the kind of person to yell it from a mountaintop. But yes, I do believe in God, I do believe in Jesus, and I do believe that my faith is a major foundation for a lot of my strength in dealing with things. It is who I believe I work for. And I'm very happy for that. If I have one regret, it's that I don't know how to give it to people. Sometimes I would love to be able to give somebody that kind of a foundation. I just don't know how to do it. I don't know how to give somebody faith, because obviously you can't do it by proof. It's just those kind of contradictions and of sorts. But yes, it is a big part of my life, just kind of a quieter one.
Boy, I could talk about these areas for a whole nother hour with you, Doug. We don't have excuse me. We don't have the time for that, obviously. Doug, tell me, and I know very well the answer to this, how did you find For the People? And talk about your involvement on For the People. You're very involved, and maybe more than most people know.
Well, I was minding my own business on the JAWS scripting list, which is a mailing list for people that write scripts for JAWS, which, as I said, is my primary responsibility for my job right now. And up comes a message advertising, and I don't remember exactly the sequence of messages, but a message saying, you know, there was just going to be this forum for scripters on For the People. And I thought, okay, For the People, that's an interesting name for an organization, or is that a website or whatever. Sounds interesting. Be kind of nice to be able to have people talk about scripting. It would be faster than a mailing list. But it was kind of an off-the-side, you know, kind of haphazard thought. Next thing you know, I get a message from Steve Shepard. It says he wanted me to help run it. I'm like, oh, whoa, wait a minute. Now, this is personal. Now, I can't just sort of sit here and just watch this happen. And I thought, you know, wait a minute, I've tried being a teacher. I don't really want to run this. And this is one of those where I kind of declined. And I said, you know, okay, I can come and answer questions, but I don't really want to run it. I want somebody else to run this thing. Well, he kept at it, and he finally got me to at least come in and be part of it. And he got me to sign up, and I think he got my membership through pretty fast. And then I got a big surprise, which is that I knew the site director. I met her 10 years before in a chat room. But so my getting into For the People was very specifically and exclusively caused by one Steve Shepard. He got me on here to do the forum, and I did actually help with that for a while. But in the process of helping with that, I got to know a lot of other people, and I saw a lot of other rooms, and I thought, man, this is a busy place. There's a lot of people. There's a lot of activities. It's not a marginal case at all. There's always something going on, sometimes even at 4:30 in the morning. And so I just started coming back because I made friends here. And then I noticed there were some scripts for the people, and I thought, well, I know I can contribute some of my know-how to this, but what really happened there is I was trying to be in a room where you could do chats, which isn't permitted in most rooms, this one or most of the other rooms on the site, because it distracts people. But there are one or two places where it is, and I decided, well, I'm just going to add a system for dealing with that in case I need it, because at that time I did. And then I ended up writing a lot of code. And by doing that, I got very involved in not only the process of scripting for the people, but in a lot of the kinds of things that happen, because Steve has a lot of knowledge about what people want, what people expect, how people use For the People and the program that we use to talk, Chatterbox, how people use it, what they want it to do, individual things that people want, he will know, which I wouldn't have known. And so it was very interesting to work with Steve on this, you know, being the original developer of the scripts, and adding to what he had done. But that basically caused me to get involved in a more technical sense, and then I became part of the help desk. And I answer some questions on there when I get a chance. That's probably all the involvement that would be behind the scenes. The rest of it, I'm sometimes scarce, because I'll be working at funny hours and things. Every now and then you'll see me pop up from an airport with a laptop and a wireless network connection. That's always fun. But I really do enjoy being here and doing what I can for the site and tackling problems as they come up when I actually have time to do it. It's very enjoyable. And so are the people.
And your contribution to the scripts and to the help desk has certainly been quite major and appreciated by those who know about it, and I hope now by everyone, because you add an awful lot to the site with your technical help, but also just as a friend to all of us, and just a terrific guy. Now, I was an original developer, but let me say here that these scripts are basically Doug Lee's scripts, and he has taken them to a level that was quite beyond my capability. They're basically Doug scripts now, and I'm very happy for it, because they're much the better for it. But when I look at the scripts, I say, how did he do that? I don't understand. So I had to ask Doug. When people ask me questions, I say, let me ask Doug. One more question. Well, two more questions, because we're going a little bit over time. I said that I was going to ask you, what is scripting? What exactly is JAWS scripting, Doug? And then I'm going to ask you to display a little-known talent of yours.
I might even know what that is. And I have to shoot one small comment back. I still feel like I'm building a few rooms inside your house there, Steve. I very much appreciate what you've done to the scripts, and they're very... A lot of what Steve has done is still there. I have added a lot to him, but it is a very shared effort. And I'm sorry, I forgot your question.
People ask me all the time, what is scripting? What is JAWS scripting? So let's hear your answer to that.
Well, as being partially programming, it is both an art and a science. But it isn't only programmers, as you alluded to earlier, that come to scripting. Some people come to scripting as JAWS users who are curious and technically minded. Some come out of demand. There'll be a person with a job that has a couple of little requirements and say, geez, I can't get anybody to fix this. Maybe I can fix it. And they'll try to do it. I would say there's several kinds of scripting broken down by the way people look at it. There's macro writing, which is effectively just writing a script that does the equivalent of a series of keystrokes. Script auto-maximize. To auto-maximize the screen, you can assign a key to it, it'll do an alt space and an X and an exit. Those kinds of things are sort of like macros. That's really not a logically complex construction project. But it is scripting, because it's a script. It can get things done, it can make things easier. At the other extreme, there is the complete programming case where you're actually writing a lot of code to do certain tasks. An example would be something I've recently done for Skype that is similar to something. Well, I did something a little bit like this for the people, but a lot of that is still Steve's code that did the announcement of speakers and whatnot and sign-ins and sign-outs. But for Skype, I did something to announce sign-ins and sign-outs. And there was a whole lot of code that went into doing that, and it was a programming project. Somewhere in between, there are going to be people that maybe didn't have programming, but they can look at the code that other people have done, cut and copy this or that piece of it and see if it can work and whatnot. And you can get a fair amount done that way. As a matter of fact, they say imitation is the best form of flattery, but it's also true that imitation can be the best form of succeeding at something like this when you first start out. Seeing how something's done and understanding it, but also using that or something similar, playing with it a little bit to see how it changes and what actually happens. But it's all of those things. In summary, I guess I would again say it's an artistic and a logical pursuit, but it's not like other programming languages in that you just can't get anywhere without some knowledge of programming. It'd be very hard to write much in C without knowing something of programming, I think. It'll look very strange to you if you don't. Scripting is a little bit less daunting than that, I would say.
To me, it's not much less daunting than that. Scripting, to me, is a specialized form of programming, but programming it is, and it can be quite advanced if you're at that level. Well, thank you so much, Doug, and we're going to have questions, and there might be a lot of questions for you here, Doug, because you've been a very interesting subject for an interview, and I thank you for being here today very, very much. The last thing is, Doug, I know that you are a mimic, and maybe you could give us a demonstration of your mimicry and what Doug mimics. Is not celebrities and not friends. Maybe he does that too, but he is good at being a synthesizer. So let me introduce Doug the Synthesizer. Take it away, Doug.
He Hello, I am an echo to speech synthesizer. I can take normal text and turn it into speech. That's actually an imitation of the first one I ever used. And I do get asked to do this a lot when I'm talking to people. Question is whether I can do it when I'm slightly nervous. Let's see, I had one at Bell Labs called the Votrax PSS, I think. And it talked with a very low voice that sounded very dry, dot. And it read periods as a dot, just like I did now, dot. And it sounded very much like that. It had funny names for punctuation marks. I am fairly good at imitating things that I've heard, but I'll end up doing... And the best thing I can do is to imitate words I've actually heard said. And I've heard a lot of synthesizers from the early days when they were creating them. You know, they had this thing called the Software Actuated Mouth, or SAM, for Apples and Commodores. And I heard a demo of that on a tape once. It said, "Hello, my name is Sam." You know, and I can do that very well because I remember it exactly. It actually had a list, too. But yeah, I am sort of recognized for doing that here and there for some reason.
I love it. Okay, Dougley, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to open the questioning to the floor if anyone has questions for Doug.
Well, I just want to thank you quickly, Steve, for doing the interview, and even on short notice. And thank you for getting me into For the People in the first place. Again, I think it was doubly appropriate you ended up doing this, because you got me here in the first place, and it's been a real pleasure to work with you and to hope to meet you at some point in person. I haven't managed to do that yet, but it's been a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Hi, Doug. This is Gary Wood. I think that it's been quite an interesting interview with you today, and I kind of... enjoyed hearing all the things that you do, and I appreciate the fact that you do the JAWS scripts for blind people.
I missed a couple of words because JAWS was speaking. Did you ask me how I do scripts for blind people?
No, I said I appreciate the fact that you do them for blind people. That's what I'm... I guess maybe I'll ask you a question while I'm here, though. What do you feel that... I mean... do you feel that you have, is there any one thing that you feel that you've missed by not attending a school for the blind as opposed to being in a public school situation?
Well, like I said, it was very interesting, an interesting feeling to go there. I would say the thing I missed would be there was a very intense, at the one I went to at least, there was a very intense concentration on the athletic program. I don't find a lot of mainstream blind people getting into that as much. You know, gym classes, the ball games, the soccer ball, volleyball, all that stuff. I mean, I did bowling in high school for gym a lot of times, and weightlifting, a very small amount of wrestling. My brother actually did go into a wrestling team, but I usually don't see that. When I went to Jacksonville, I had a coach that earned every single letter of the word coach, and he also about killed me. He got me from a 440-meter dash with absolutely nothing left but, you know, barely the ability to breathe fast enough. In 4 weeks, he got me to run a 1,500-meter dash without feeling any ill effects. In between times, I called home. I said, "This guy's going to kill me off." But I have never, ever had anyone train me that hard physically. And I suspect a lot of sighted people know exactly what that is. I think a lot of sighted people go through that. Maybe it's just where I've been, but I don't think that... I have not seen that in a public setting. I didn't happen to have an athletic pursuit, so that didn't turn out to matter much. But real quickly, I will say that I reaped one fascinating benefit. That summer, after I'd been to that program, I went to the Illinois State Fair. And there's this really big, tall slide that you have all kinds of stairs, flights and flights and flights of stairs. You go up, and you get a gunny sack, and you slide down the slide on it, because if you don't slide down on something, you're going to burn your rear, and it's really long. And I was running up the stairs and going down the slide, running up the stairs and going down the slide, running up the stairs. Kept doing this over and over and over, and my parents were like, "We're going to stay at the bottom." And I thought, how in the world did I manage to do this? And then I realized that for the only time in my life, I was in excellent physical shape. So So if I had to say I missed something, that would probably be it.
Okay, now, are there any other questions for Doug Lee?
Hi, Doug. This is Chris Maddox. Just want to say a couple things. Good interview today. I really enjoyed it about the scripting, and want to say I enjoy the scripts very much, and I think for blind people, I think they work very well, and I've really liked them. They're very useful. I have a question on the scripting deal.
Goodbye.
How long did you go to college, to get your scripting? I know you had to go to college and get education for that type of thing. So I was just wondering, how many years study was it, and did you like it?
Well, I certainly did like it. I didn't go to college specifically for scripting. I was a mainstream programmer before I was a scripter. I actually had a 5-year programming job in a mainstream company, a small one, a company that wrote software for organizations, school districts, and whatnot. But the college courses that I took, it was a 4-year plan or 4-year system. I took 5 years going through it, which I found was sort of common. Technically, I ended up getting out about 7 years after I started, but that's because there was a long time in the middle of it that I wasn't there. I was doing other things, like going to Minnesota for training. But my college education was specifically to get a computer science degree, and it was in every sense of the word the same kind of degree that you would get sighted or blind. It wasn't specific to scripting. Scripting came a lot easier because I was already a programmer. But that's probably the best answer I would have for that one.
Hi, Doug. It's Mike. And I just wanted to thank you for coming on Spotlight and letting us interview you. As well, I'd like to thank Steve for coming in and filling in as a last-minute replacement. It's greatly appreciated, Steve. Becky and Dennis, thank you for your parts in doing this as well. It was a great interview, and definitely enjoyed it.
Well, I think it's slightly ironic, Mike. I totally forgot. I never mentioned the fact that I have also downhill skied twice, enjoyed it, decided it was too expensive to do regularly. But your nickname containing the word ski, I just suddenly realized I never even mentioned that.